So this is Parashat Noach, as you can see from there. In many ways, this is a continuation of some of the ideas that were raised in last week's excellent sermon.
Well, I did my best. He said modestly.
Where we heard, some of you perhaps for the first time, about the idea that there may be two versions of the creation account in Bereshit. And according to this proposition, Bereshit chapter 1 represents a priestly account of the creation from a textual source that modern biblical scholars have called P. And Bereshit 2, it's suggested, comes from a source they call J, the Yahwist text, because J is how Germans pronounce the letter Y. So the Y becomes a J, Juden, like in Jews. So over the course of the past couple of centuries, scholars have become convinced that Bereshit 1 and 2 came from different pens, or should that be quills? And they tell the story of creation from two different perspectives. According to Bereshit chapter 1, therefore God made the first human beings sometime on the sixth day, creating at least two of them simultaneously, as it says, male and female, he created them. And then in the next chapter, we see that the creation of human beings is described in different terms. Here is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created. So it's going back to study the restore of the creation account. On the day when Adonai God made heaven and earth, so that's on the same day, is that the first day? There was as yet no wild bush on the earth, and no wild plant had as yet sprung up. For Adonai God had not caused it to rain on the earth, and there was no one to cultivate the ground. Rather, a mist went up from the earth, which watered the entire surface of the ground. Then Adonai God formed a person from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, so that he became a living being. Adonai God planted a garden toward the east in Eden, and there he put the person whom he had formed. Out of the ground Adonai God caused to grow every tree, pleasing in appearance and good for food, including the tree of life in the middle of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And there then follows in the Bereshit 2 account the narrative of how God created animals and the first woman. Adonai God said, "It isn't good that the person should be alone. I will make for him a companion suitable for helping him." So from the ground Adonai God formed every wild animal and every wild bird that flies in the air. And he brought them to the person to see what he would call them. Whatever the person would call each living creature, that was to be its name. So the person gave names to all the livestock, to the birds in the air, and to every wild animal. But for Adam, there was not found a companion suitable help for helping him. Then God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the person, and while he was sleeping, he took one of his ribs and closed up the place from which he took it with flesh. The rib which Adonai God had taken from the person, he made a woman person, and he brought her to the man person. The man person said at last, "This is bone from my bones and flesh from my flesh. She is to be called woman because she was taken out of man. This is why a man is to leave his father and mother and stick with his wife, and they're to be one flesh. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed." So there you go. It's the first theft. God stole our rib and made women out of it, and we want them back. It's about time. The differences between Bereshit 1 and 2 are quite dramatic. As Professor James Kugel, an Orthodox Jew and Torah expert, comments this effect, according to Bereshit 2, Adam seems to be the first human in history, and he is at first very much alone, almost as if the creation recounted in chapter 1 had never happened. God puts Adam alone in the Garden of Eden to live, then creates all the animals and has Adam name them, and only after that goes on to create Eve. Not only do chapters 1 and 2 seem to differ in some of their details, but they also depict God's actions in quite different ways. In chapter 1, God is represented as cosmic sovereign. He speaks, gives orders, and as a result, things just come into existence. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. In chapters 2 and 3, by contrast, he seems to be more of a divine craftsman. He himself shapes Adam out of the fresh mud of the earth, and then breathes air into his nostrils to start his life. This seems to be a more hands-on approach to creating. Later, God is said to walk about the garden, very much like a human being. When Adam and Eve hide from him, he calls out, "Where are you?" Apparently, he himself does not know. At the end, God makes leather clothes for the pair, another hands-on act that seems at odds with the cosmic deity portrayed in chapter 1. As Kugel notes, the differences between Bereshit 1 and 2 are evident in the stated chronology of each act of creation, with the second chapter, for instance, placing the creation of Adam before that of vegetation and animals. Bereshit 1, however, the vegetation is created on the third day, birds and sea creatures on the fifth day, and land animals at the beginning of the sixth day, after which Adam and Eve are created simultaneously. But these chapters are also linguistically different. The Hebrew is different from Bereshit 1 and 2. And this is nowhere more evident than in the constant use in the text of Bereshit 1 with the word Elohim to reference to God. Bereshit 2, however, never uses Elohim. Instead, as we end Bereshit 1 with its singular use of Elohim for God and begin the second chapter, we're immediately struck by the singular use of the tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which we pronounce in Judaism as Adonai, Lord. Other differences are evident in the respective theological outlooks of the chapters. As Kugel's noted, the text of Bereshit 1 sees God as a distant deity, creating all things from afar simply by the word of his mouth. He gives orders, and then, standing still from afar, pronounces satisfaction over what he has made, that it is tov, good. And this vision of a more distant cosmic God is in contrast to that of Bereshit 2, where God molds Adam from clay with his hands, personally breathes life into his nostrils, reaches into his side with his hands, and creates the woman. This God in Bereshit 2 is much more hands-on and intimate, and on the earth. He's walking in the garden. Thus it is that scholars believe Bereshit 1 and 2 come from different source traditions, and from different authors, therefore, with a different way of seeing both God and the world that he created. The scholarly identification of Bereshit 1 with a priestly textual source has been made by scholars on a number of bases, one of which was the apparent suggestion that this first chapter has much in common with other similarly identified passages in Torah that relate to the subject of priests and their duties in the sanctuary. Scholars point to the occurrence of certain common words favored by this priestly source, which occur in Bereshit 1 as well. The word for work there, melacha, is used dozens of times in the apparent priestly source, but not nearly so much elsewhere in the Bible. And it's this word melacha that is used three times in the last two sentences of the Bereshit 1 creation account, almost like a priestly signature. Wherever this priestly source has been identified by scholars within the Torah, so they tell us, the source tradition demonstrates a concern for numbers and order, a concern which is also found in Bereshit 1. And indeed, it's been observed that the priestly source never uses the tetragrammaton prior to the revelation in Shemot 6 verse 2, which we have here, that then God spoke to Moses, telling him, "I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Adonai, Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but I did not make my name Yahweh known to them." Up until this point in Shemot, the priestly source doesn't use the tetragrammaton. After this point, it also uses it. The priestly text also avoids depicting God in human terms, preferring to present him as a great cosmic deity or spirit. As eminent theologian Gerhard von Rad has said, "Anyone who expounds Genesis chapter 1 must understand one thing. This chapter is priestly doctrine. Indeed, it contains the essence of priestly knowledge in a most concentrated form." But perhaps the most striking indicator of the priestly authorship of Bereshit 1 was not the not-so-small matter of the Sabbath. Shabbat indeed all of the holy days, was a matter that was dear to the priests, the ancient priesthood in Israel. Thus, scholars have deduced that the chronology of creation in Bereshit 1 is constructed so as to emphasize Shabbat as the culmination, climax, and foundation of all creation. Everything leads to one, as they used to say, all roads lead to Rome. All roads lead to Shabbat, to the Sabbath. As James Kugel again explains, this whole account of how the world was made, they said, had been set forth in this six-day scheme so as to stress the importance of the seventh day, the Sabbath. From the very beginning of the world, this priestly author was saying, the Sabbath has existed. Indeed, God arranged the creation into 6 days so as to be able to rest on the seventh day, and so should you. That, rather than a simple recitation of the facts of the creation, seemed to modern scholars to be the whole point of chapter 1. In other words, it's constructed so as to emphasize the Sabbath. God creates in a seven-day schema in order to, so that he can keep the Sabbath, and thus sets us an example so that you should do too. As God does, so we should do. The evidence that our Torah contains separate source traditions with different perspectives on the narrative and theological outlooks, but which have been woven together into a single text, mounts when we look at Parashat Noach. This is this week's portion. Just as in the creation account, so in the flood account, we find switches in the Hebrew between Elohim and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Indeed, if we separate out the lines which refer to Elohim and those that refer to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, we can recover two distinct but wholly consistent and readable accounts of the flood. So, for instance, Bereshit 6 begins, and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Adonai, saw the evil of humans was great in the earth. And all the inclination of the thoughts of their heart was only evil all the day. And Adonai regretted that he had made humans in the earth, and he was grieved to his heart. And Adonai said, I shall wipe out the humans which I have created from the face of the earth, from human to beast, to creeping thing, to bird of the heavens, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in Adonai's eyes. Here, as we saw with Bereshit 1, J or Yahwist source refers to God as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Suddenly, however, as we read through in the Hebrew, verse 9, references to God change from Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh to Elohim, indicative of the commencement of the priestly narrative. As we read, these are the generations of Noach, Elei Toldot Noach. Noach was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. Noach walked with God, Elohim. And Noach sired 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the earth was corrupted before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and here it was corrupted. For all flesh had corrupted its way on the earth. And Elohim said to Noach, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence, Hamas, because of them. And here I am going to destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms with the ark, and pitch it outside and inside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. 300 cubits the length of the ark, 50 cubits in width, and 30 cubits in height. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from the top, and you shall make an entrance to the ark in its side. You shall make lower, second, and third stories for it. And here I am bringing the flood, water, over the earth, to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life from under the heavens. Everything which is on the land will die, and I shall establish my covenant with you. And you shall come to the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of all the living, of all flesh, you shall bring 2 to the ark to keep alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds according to their kind, and of the beasts according to their kind, and of all the creeping things of the earth according to their kind, 2 of each will come to you to keep alive. And you take for yourself of all food which will be eaten, and gather it to you, and it will be for you and for them food. And Noah did according to all that Elohim commanded him, so he did. And so what we have here is verses 1 to 8. God is referred to by the tetragrammaton, Yud Hei Vav Hei. You can see that in your Hebrew. And then from 9 to 22, God is referred to as Elohim exclusively. There's no switching within sentences. And then in chapter 7, verses 1 to 5, we find the text reverts back to referring to God as Yud Hei Vav Hei. As we read, and Adonai, Yud Hei Vav Hei, said to Noah, come you and all your household to the ark, for I have seen you as righteous before me in this generation. Of all the clean beasts, take yourself seven pairs, man and his woman, and of the beasts which are not clean, two, man and his woman. Also of the birds of the heavens, seven pairs, male and female, to keep alive seed on the face of the earth. For in seven more days I shall reign on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I shall wipe out all the substance that I have made from upon the face of the earth. And Noah did according to all that Adonai, Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, had commanded him. And so the narrative continues to tell through the story of the flood, and it swaps time and again the name of God from Elohim to Yud-Heh Vav-Heh and back again. What is particularly interesting, as I've hinted, is that if one separates out and puts these Elohim passages together, and after that the Yud-Heh Vav-Heh passages together, the result are two narratives that are fully readable and consistent stories all by themselves. If we take the Yud-Heh Vav-Heh passages, for instance, in Bereshit 6 and 7, we find that the statement in 6 verse 8, but Noah found favor in Yud-Heh Vav-Heh's eyes, flows naturally to the next instance of the Tetragrammaton in Bereshit 7:1. And Yud-Heh Vav-Heh said to Noah, come you and your household to the ark, for I have seen you as righteous before me in this generation. I think we have this in the next slide. Next slide. Nope, that's not the one. Never mind. In both cases, the same can be said of the texts that also use Elohim as God. In both cases, there are other variances in the Hebrew that also mark these passages out as being from separate source traditions. There are further significant differences in the narrative. As Friedman helpfully observes, the priestly version, the one that refers to God as Elohim, has one pair of each kind of animal. The J version, which refers to God as Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, has seven pairs of clean animals and one pair of unclean animals. The priestly version pictures the flood as lasting a year. J says it was 40 days and 40 nights. P has Noah send out a raven, J says a dove. P obviously has a concern for ages, dates, and measurements in cubits. J does not. Friedman continues, probably the most remarkable difference of all between the two is their different ways of picturing God. It is not just that they call the deity by different names. J pictures a deity who can regret things that he has done, which raises interesting theological questions, such as whether an all-powerful, all-knowing being would ever regret past actions. It pictures a deity who can be grieved to his heart, who personally closes the ark and smells Noah's sacrifice. This anthropomorphic quality of J is virtually entirely lacking in P. Remember, back in Bereshit, P is, that represents a God who is the cosmic God who stands from afar and proclaims, let there be light, whereas the other one is much more intimate and involved. This anthropomorphic quality of J is virtually entirely lacking in P. There, God is regarded more as a transcendent controller of the universe. Friedman thus concludes, the two flood stories are separable and complete. Each has its own language, its own details, and even its own conception of God. And even that is not the whole picture. The J flood story's language, details, and conception of God are consistent with the language, details, and conception of God in other J stories. The P flood story is consistent with other P stories, and so on. The investigators found each of the sources to be a consistent collection of stories, poems, and laws. And so the woven nature of our Torah and of biblical texts in general is testament to the fact that in ancient Israel there were a multiplicity of source traditions, stories, interpretations of events, and ideas about God. amongst our ancient forebears. To the modern believing mind, this realization may at first feel somewhat troubling. After all, one might say, what are we to believe then? Shouldn't there just be a single narrative if God is writing this? A single account and perspective on events? And yet, do we not also have four Gospels? What's the point of that? And each of those Gospels presents us with a different perspective, and even differs in small and some large details too. The fact is that ancient Hebrews did not think the way that we think today about Scripture. They apparently had no difficulty holding together multiple points of view, either in relation of biblical events or in their interpretation and theological outlook too. The fact that today's believers find this difficult to handle is, in my opinion, as a result of the church's creation of the idea of heresy, otherwise known as religious thought crime, which barely existed prior to the 2nd century CE in Judaism, and its imposition on us of a singular set of beliefs, codified by endless church councils in creed after creed throughout the ages. The church pursued those who demurred from these creeds, vigorously pursuing singularity of thought and doctrine, with threats of heresy, excommunication, actual burning at the stake for believing something different, and the promise of eternal damnation in a lake of fire alongside Satan and his demons. You dared not believe anything else but the creed. The church pursued singularity of thought and doctrine. But thankfully, that is not the way of Judaism, which to the contrary has, as we've seen from the very earliest times, welcomed a multiplicity of ideas, discourse and debate, diversity in thought, as is evident from the woven nature of our Hebrew scriptures. It's woven like a garment from different threads, and it is beautiful because of that, a tapestry of our people. And if you think about it this way, the redactor of the Hebrew scriptures, the person who put all of this together, might simply have used a single source tradition and got rid of all the other ones in pursuit of a single narrative and theology, but he didn't. Rather, he was concerned with the maximal preservation of traditions. The very fact that not just Bereshit, as we've seen, but the whole Torah is woven together from these separate strands into a singular but diverse entity from separate source traditions with different theological perspectives, teaches us that in Judaism, at least in ancient Judaism, there was the freedom to think differently without fear or of accusation or condemnation or damnation. The redactor was keen to preserve and not to expunge the many different points of view that it is possible to hold about God. And we see this internal debate within Scripture all the time in our Hebrew Scriptures. And we should, if we want to be a Judaism, we should also embrace this diversity. If Messianic Judaism is truly to be a Judaism, and not just a form of evangelicalism with Hebraic bells on, then those who have come out of that, from that very background, need to open their minds and hearts and embrace the diversity that has characterized Judaism and the Jewish people from the very beginning. But just like our scriptures, we are a woven people. We are a diverse and plural people with many different backgrounds, theologies and ideas woven together by God as one. We are a tapestry of God's making. The phrase Am Echad, one people, does not mean that we must only have one point of view. As the former chief rabbi, emeritus chief rabbi Jonathan Sacks has cogently observed, the beauty of creation, as we believe, and as science ever more wondrously shows, is that unity above creates diversity below. And the more complex the life form, the greater the diversity. The Rambam, says that though diversity applies to all life forms, it applies more to humans than any other, to which one must surely add, and among Jews more than most. No small people is more diverse ethnically, culturally, attitudinally, and religiously. And the more religious, the more diverse. There was hardly a Jewish settlement in the Middle Ages without its own minhagim, its own customs, and piyutim. In the 18th and 19th century, each Hasidic group and yeshiva had its own style, its own nigunim, its own derech halimud, its own way of learning, its own role models, its own spiritual tonality. The way of Ge'er was not that of Chabad. That of Voloshin was not that of Mir. Diversity is a sign of strength, not weakness. As Rav Yechiel Michael Epstein notably said in the introduction of Aruch HaShulchan to Choshen Mishpat, in the very last of the 613 commands, the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah, Moses uses not the word Torah, but Shira. That its greatest beauty lies in complex harmonies. Or as the Netziv writes in his commentary to the Tower of Babel, uniformity of thought is not a sign of freedom, but its opposite. Almost everything I read in Torah, Tanakh, and Torah, Sheva Alpe, seems to say likewise. Judaism is the only religion I know, all of whose canonical texts are anthologies of arguments. Arguments between God and humans. Humans and God. Humans and one another. The Mishnah preserves the arguments of the sages, even when it knows that the law is like one, not the other. The greatest work ever undertaken to eliminate argument from its pages was the Mishneh Torah, and it gave rise to more arguments than any other. So difference, argument, clashes of style and substance are signs not of unhealthy division, but of health. The Judaism of Torah, emunah, that means trusting faithfulness, and halacha, the way we keep Torah, continues to do what it has done for so long, to defeat the law of entropy that states all systems lose energy over time. Not Judaism. Where you find argument, there you will find passion. And of course, you are completely free to disagree with me and to say that I've not got it right. And I'm sure some of you may think that this morning. But as we grow as a Judaism, we find that singularity of thought is not what keeps us together. It's the sense of body. It's the sense of peoplehood. It's the sense that we are God's people. It's the sense that we have a divine mission to bring, to see the kingdom of heaven established here on earth by our actions, by what we do. As Yeshua said, you can sum up the Torah with this: love your neighbor as yourself. And as you do that, you are loving Hashem himself. And so we're going to have, as a community, different ideas. And that is, we are all the more stronger for it. So with that, let's just conclude with a short prayer.